everybody. Welcome back. This is VLMD Rounds, and I am Dr. Vivian Low. If you're finding this channel useful for you, I hope you will like it and also subscribe. You can also get information about the work that I do on my website, VivianLowMD.com, VYVYANELOHMD.com. I also am conducting several live Q&A sessions that I'd be happy to have you participate in. So if you look on the website, you'll see the dates for upcoming live stream episodes. And this is where I'll be answering questions that you may have related to previous episodes. Also taking requests for any topics that you would like to see me cover in the future. Okay, we have slowly been inching our way towards today's topic on insulin resistance. We started off with an episode on carbohydrates and how they are absorbed and transported in the body. Then I went on to talk about low blood sugar or hypoglycemia, how that is regulated in your body. We went on to talk about the opposite situation when you have high levels of glucose in your blood, how that can be toxic and damaging to your body and what your body does in response to hyperglycemia to regulate that. Today now we will be going on finally to talk about insulin resistance. Let's go. All right, so up to this point, I just want to emphasize that when we have talked about insulin, we have mostly focused on the glucose disposal aspects of insulin, all right? How insulin as a hormone helps your body regulate your blood sugar levels. Now, that's obviously very important, but I just want to emphasize that insulin does a whole lot of other things in your body. So, for example, insulin, we talked about the signaling pathway. When it binds to the insulin receptor, there's a signaling pathway that basically ends up with the GLUT4 transporter being moved from a compartment or endosome within the cell to the plasma membrane to help bring in glucose into the cell. Well, there are other signaling pathways that can happen when insulin binds to the insulin receptor. So we can have also the activation of the MAPK-ERK pathway. MAPK is mitogen-associated protein kinase pathways, and part of that is the ERK pathway or pathways, right? ERK, E-R-K, and that would be for extracellular signal-related protein kinases. Now, those pathways are actually for growth, cell survival, proliferation, right? And they help your body deal with cell stress and so forth. So they are very important in your body. So we're always focused on the glucose aspects, but insulin is also an anabolic hormone, A-N-A-B-O-L-I-C, right? And we talked about anabolism and how that means it helps you build tissues in your body. It promotes cell growth. It is a growth factor, right? And it is through the MAPK and ERK pathways where we see insulin's function in helping to promote cell growth and so forth. Now, insulin also interacts with other enzymes and cell signals in the body. So you might have heard of, for example, mTOR, the mammalian target of rapamycin. And this is really a system that prioritizes cell growth. It's involved in metabolism as well. And if we're talking especially of muscle synthesis, protein synthesis, then we also need mTOR to be in play. mTOR is preserved across all species, really. But in multicellular organisms, it is under also the control, besides other nutrient signals and energy signals, in multicellular organisms, it's also under the control of growth factors like insulin and insulin-like growth factor 1, okay, IGF-1. So there is a play between mTOR and insulin signaling, right? When you have insulin and glucose in your body, you can upregulate mTOR and muscle synthesis in your body. If you have overstimulation of mTOR, that can also interfere with insulin signaling, right? So it's not a one-way street. These reactions generally aren't, and they influence each other one way and the other. So again, want to focus your attention for you to think about other functions of insulin besides just the glucose disposal aspects of it, all right? Insulin is also very important in your vasculature health, right? Blood vessel health. So with insulin, we can increase the production of nitric oxide via endothelial nitric oxide synthase, this enzyme, which is in the cells lining the blood vessels. And this will produce nitric oxide, which is a gas, which has great effects on your blood vessel health. So for example, it vasodilates blood vessels, so it helps the blood vessel relax, the walls of the blood vessels relax, so that you facilitate more blood flow there. And it decreases the proliferation of these vascular smooth muscle cells in the wall of the blood vessel. It decreases the adhesion of inflammatory cells and platelet aggregation, right? So we have a lot of benefits from nitric oxide, and insulin really increases nitric oxide via ENOS so that we have healthy blood vessels. Now, it can also act the other way when other pathways are stimulated. So if insulin is activated through the MAPK pathway and overstimulated via that pathway, it can have opposite results as well, so that we have actually more vasoconstriction and narrowing of blood vessels and decreased blood flow through increasing endothelin 1, for example. So that's if we prioritize the MAPK pathway. So you can see that insulin has numerous functions in the body, and it's very context specific, like most things in your body, right? With insulin as well, we increase blood flow and we open capillary beds that are maybe not in use in muscle, so that we can prioritize glucose disposal that way during exercise and also after a meal. Okay, so those are the various things that we can think about when we talk about insulin, apart from just the glucose disposal aspects, all right? Just want us to keep that in mind. Now, obviously, when we are in a situation where you consume a lot of carbohydrates, then we're going to be cranking out some insulin there, because as we mentioned in the previous episode, high glucose in your bloodstream is very damaging. And as a protective effect, you are going to make insulin to decrease the blood sugar levels. If, however, you continue to eat lots of carbohydrates and you eat all day, right, and you keep, you know, just racking up the blood sugar levels in your bloodstream, then you're basically going to keep your pancreas very busy, because those beta cells are going to continue to make insulin in response to that high energy situation. and continue to try to protect your body from glucose toxicity. Now, over time, as this situation continues, you know, your body keeps cranking out the insulin, and we are going to be in a state of hyperinsulinemia. So essentially, this just means you have high levels of insulin now in the bloodstream. So we started off, if you consume a lot of carbohydrates, then you are going to have high blood sugar, hyperglycemia. In response, we make insulin. And if we persist in keeping the blood sugar high through dietary consumption, then we are going to stimulate the pancreas to keep making insulin in response to that high sugar load. So now we get a corresponding hyperinsulinemic condition. So we had high blood sugar, but now we crank up the insulin. We have high insulin levels as well in the bloodstream. And initially, this is helpful in controlling the sugar levels in the blood, right? So it's sort of trying to match the levels of glucose that you are having in the bloodstream. The higher you have of that, the higher the insulin. And over time, though, this chronic condition of hyperinsulinemia leads to some problems. Eventually, we get to the point where that insulin isn't as functional, isn't acting the way it normally should, okay? So that it's not as efficient in doing its job with relation to the glucose disposal aspects, okay, of insulin. All right? So over time, high levels of insulin now make it less and less functional in handling that glucose load. And we call that condition insulin resistance. One way that I use to illustrate this to my patients is with this little analogy. So imagine that every night after work, my job is to take the trash can from my office and empty it into the dumpster before I go home, all right? So that's my job. Every night I take out the trash, I dump it in the dumpster, and then the next morning when you come in and you look in the trash can, it's empty, right? So I've done my job. That's great. So this goes on for some time. One day, however, as I'm going to empty the trash can, I try to pick it up and I find that I'm struggling. It's the same load of trash, it's the same size trash can, but now somehow I am not able to pick up that load by myself. So I try to get some help. So I'll ask Driss, my office manager, Driss, can you help me take the trash out? And you know, of course, he'll come over and both of us will lift that trash can, take it out to the dumpster, dump the trash, come back in. So now every night, it's myself and Driss emptying the trash can. But in the morning, when you look in the trash can, it's empty. So what do you care, right? Someone's doing their job. That's wonderful. Great. Okay. So one day, we're emptying the trash. And as we're trying to pick up this trash can, again, same load of trash, same trash can, we're not really managing to do that. The two of us are struggling to lift that trash can, and we're going to get some help from someone else. So we'll find someone else in the office to come over, help us pick up that trash can. Now there's three of us. Taking this trash out, get it to the dumpster, dump the trash, come back in. Finally got the trash out. But in the morning, when you look in the trash can, it's empty. So Dr. Lowe's doing a good job. Except it's not just Dr. Lowe. It's Dr. Lowe and Drist and someone else. And there's three of us trying to take that trash out every night. Over time, yes, you guessed it, we need more help. So instead of three people, now we have five people taking out the same load of trash. So you can see that each person has become less and less effective in their job, right? It used to just take one person to empty the trash can, and now five people are doing it, and very soon eight people are doing it, and then very soon 10 people are taking out the same load of trash. But what do you care? Because in the morning when you come in and you look at the trash, it's empty. Hey, no problem. Someone's doing their job. Well, some 10 people are doing the job, not one person, right? That's the part that doesn't get discussed. So if we think of the trash load as glucose, right? So we have that amount of glucose that needs to be handled. And over time, it's requiring more and more people to take out the trash. And yet in the morning, when you look in the trash can, it's empty. So there's no problem here, right? And this is what happens when we only focus on the glucose aspects and we check the A1C, and that's normal. There isn't a problem. So why worry, right? You're fine. And then one day, 10 of us go to try to empty the trash can, and we're just not able to. We're just not able to take that trash out to the dumpster. Now when you come in the morning, there's still trash in the trash can. Okay, that blood glucose level is high. And suddenly, you have diabetes, right? I kind of really hate that word suddenly in medicine, because we act as if, you know, tra-la-la, nothing's going on, and then like magic, one day you wake up and suddenly this has befallen you, right? You're suddenly diabetic at this point. When in actual fact, this has been brewing for some time. We've just not paid attention to the right things. We were focused on the trash can being empty, and nobody was asking the question of how many people now is it taking to empty the trash can? Okay, so as the insulin level starts to climb and you're requiring more and more insulin to handle a fixed load of glucose, right? As long as the blood glucose level looks normal, when you check the A1C, it looks normal, right? Nobody is thinking that something is wrong in your body, okay? And that's why you know, diabetes actually takes 10, 15, 20 years to develop, but trouble has been brewing for some time before someone suddenly gets a diagnosis of diabetes. Okay, so you can think of that happening in the case of someone who has A1C levels that are normal, abnormal, right? Out of the blue, all of a sudden, what happened? And it was, again, we were not looking at the insulin. We were only focused on the A1C or the glucose levels. Okay, so when that happens and someone gets diagnosed with diabetes, you know, then there's probably the start of medications and so forth. And at that point in time, we're still really not even talking about insulin when someone has a full diagnosis of diabetes. Over time, you know, as the beta cells in the pancreas are cranking out more and more insulin to help manage blood sugar levels in your body, we basically overwork those cells, right? And those cells burn out. And so we get to that burnt out stage of type 2 diabetes. Here, again, I'm focusing on type 2, not type 1, which is an autoimmune disease. Type 2 diabetes, right? And when you get to that stage where you have burnt out beta cells, then you're really not producing much of your own insulin. And that's when people will need to rely on exogenous injections of insulin and other medications to help manage their blood sugar levels. Okay, there are many, many things that go into causing insulin resistance, right? Inflammatory cytokines can do that, right? We activate different pathways in the body that stimulate more inflammation, and that can cause this state of insulin resistance. Several years ago, though, I started thinking about insulin resistance, and a question came to my mind. Now, I wonder if glycation has a role here. In the previous episode, we talked about glycation and how this is a spontaneous, non-enzymatic reaction between sugars and proteins, let's say, in your body. Could be other substances, could be lipids, could be DNA as well. But, you know, between proteins and sugars, that's what we'll focus on here. When we have this glycation reaction happening, then we form these compounds that are very stable. The bonds between the protein and the sugars are very stable, right? And these are glycated end products, advanced glycation end products. And they are very, very inflammatory, and they gunk up, as I said, different structures. Okay, so as I was thinking about this, I thought, you know, there are many reasons for insulin resistance, but I wonder if we could glycate the insulin receptor. And so I looked, and sure enough, there was a paper that I came across that showed that when you have high levels of glucose in solution, you actually can glycate, have that glycation reaction occur with the insulin receptor. Now, don't forget, these insulin receptors are also proteins, all right? So when you glycate the insulin receptor, then you modify its structure. And when you do that, then insulin cannot properly bind and signal such that you get the translocation of GLUT4 to the plasma membrane to help dispose of your blood glucose levels. Okay, but then upon further digging in preparation for today's episode, I just thought, let me take another look. And it turns out that not only do you glycate the insulin receptor, you can also glycate insulin itself. All right, so you actually are modifying, now insulin is a protein, so now you are actually modifying the insulin protein itself. Okay, and in conditions of chronic hyperglycemia, so someone who has not been controlling their blood sugar levels for a long time, and they have high levels of glucose in the bloodstream for a long period of time, up to 10 to 12% of the insulin that they produce could be glycated. That's a huge amount of insulin in your body that's formed that is glycated, right? And again, once you have glycated insulin, it changes the structure. And with receptor binding structure, conformation is very, very, very important. So if either the insulin receptor is modified in some way, or the insulin itself is modified in some way, this is going to impact the ability of insulin to bind to the insulin receptor. And if we don't have proper binding, to the insulin receptor, then you're not going to initiate the signaling cascade that occurs to bring GLUT4 to the plasma membrane and bring glucose into the cell. So while that is not the only pathway by which we can see insulin resistance develop, I think it's a significant one. And glycation really is, you know, a process that is very, very toxic to the body. You, as I said in the previous episode, also increase a lot of these reactive oxygen species through the NOX enzyme, right? And this creates more inflammatory cytokines, which in itself will also cause insulin resistance. So it's kind of this vicious cycle that develops. Okay, now that we've talked about a possible pathway by which we can develop insulin resistance, there's something else that I want to emphasize, which is this. Again, that was with regard to what the glucose disposal aspect of insulin. Now, in insulin resistance, what we see is that we can actually have an imbalance of insulin signaling within the cell, so that we have defective glucose disposal aspects of insulin, but we may actually at the same time be upregulating other insulin pathways, primarily the MAPK-ERK pathways. All right, remember those pathways, I said, are involved with cell survival, with apoptosis, with cell stress, with differentiation and proliferation of cells. Okay, so with the augmentation and the amplification of the MAPK-ERK pathways in comparison to the GLUT4 pathways, right? Now we have a system that is prioritized towards proliferation, cell growth, right? And inflammatory signaling. And this may be one reason that insulin resistance can set you up for development of cancer, because cancer is unregulated cell growth, right? And through the MAPK and ERK pathways especially, we can see that upregulation influencing, for example, cancer growth. So some of the characteristics of insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome which develop are from augmentation of that MAPK-ERK pathways as compared to the glucose disposal pathways, right? So just to keep in mind that when we talk about insulin resistance, it's really a selective process, and what we're doing is down-regulating the glucose disposal aspects of insulin, and we may be up-regulating other pathways of insulin function, right? And that imbalance in the cell sets you up for disease, okay? So let's go back and think about some of the basic functions of insulin. Now, from previous episodes, you know that when you have insulin in high amounts in the fed state, you have increased insulin in the body. And what insulin is going to do is not only help bring glucose into muscle and fat cells through GLUT4, in muscle and in liver, it's going to increase what? Glycogen synthesis, right? So in taking that glucose, and we're going to promote the storage of that glucose in the form of glycogen in muscle and also in the liver. What about in the fat cell and in the liver? Well, we're going to bring in the glucose into the fat cells, and then we're going to store the energy as triacylglycerols, right? Fat, right? So we'll make these triacylglycerols and incorporate it into the fat droplets in the fat cell. This also happens in the liver, where they can then be loaded onto lipoproteins for transport to different parts of the body. Okay, that is the normal functioning of insulin. Okay, we got that. Now, when we talk about insulin resistance, we made it clear that insulin now is not functioning normally, right? So as a result, what happens? You don't efficiently take in glucose via GLUT4, right? We talked about that. But also, normally, for example, in the presence of insulin, right, we have what? Lipogenesis in fat cells and in liver. We make fat in fat cells and in liver, right? And we inhibit lipolysis. We inhibit the breakdown and release of fats, right? We're actually storing the fats. We're not releasing it in the presence of insulin normally. But if we're talking about insulin-resistant states, then even though insulin is high, right, we'll have some lipogenesis, yes, but we're also seeing some lipolysis. We're seeing the release of fats into the bloodstream, free fatty acids into the bloodstream. This is abnormal because with insulin, you normally inhibit that process. You're not breaking down the fat. But because we're saying the insulin doesn't work, right? Insulin resistance. Okay, so if the normal function of insulin is lipogenesis and inhibition of lipolysis, then when it's not working, the lipogenesis isn't working as well, and we are seeing some lipolysis as well. So we are actually releasing free fatty acids into the bloodstream. Okay, so when we say someone is insulin resistant, a lot of times we only focus on the glucose and we say, oh, you know, the blood glucose is high and they're diabetic and so forth. But we are also inappropriately increasing free fatty acids in the bloodstream at the same time. And in the liver, for example, we should be storing the glucose as glycogen, and we shouldn't be breaking down the glycogen and releasing more glucose. But because, again, the insulin isn't working properly, you see some of that happening. On top of that, normally when you have high insulin, you suppress glucagon. Right, you suppress glucagon secretion. And remember, glucagon is going to promote gluconeogenesis it's going to promote the breakdown of glycogen, for example, right? So normally when you have high insulin, your glucagon is low so that you're not making or releasing more glucose. However, in insulin-resistant states, the insulin, again, isn't functioning properly, so we have more glucagon action than you normally would have for that level of insulin. And yes, we are going to now have more glucose forming inappropriately, right? Because you already are in a high glucose situation, but you are still having some glucagon action there, right? Because the insulin isn't functioning the way it should. So I want you to think through that, because a lot of times people, you know, will talk about insulin and go, well, insulin makes you fat. You know, it makes you store the glucose and carbs as fat. True. And it's doing that to protect you. Okay? It's doing that because that's a way that we can get the glucose out of the bloodstream, right? And sequester it in muscle, sequester it in fat. in the form of glycogen, in the case of muscle, and also liver, in the form of fat, in the fat cell and in liver. And that's the way that we can get that glucose out of the bloodstream to protect you. That is the protective function of insulin. So we're used to talking about insulin as this villain that is making you fat, when in actual fact, it's probably more accurately the superhero trying to protect you from the adverse effects of glucose toxicity. It's when insulin is not functioning properly, when we have the situation of insulin resistance, probably because partly the insulin receptor itself is glycated and the insulin hormone itself is glycated, and therefore the structures are distorted and changed, right? So we don't have the normal signaling, insulin signaling pathways, right? That we start to see problems forming. And now, because insulin cannot do its regular job, we have inappropriate lipolysis in the setting of high insulin, and we have inappropriate glucose formation in the setting of high insulin and high glucose already in the bloodstream. So that is what we mean by insulin resistance. Those free fatty acids, by the way, are very toxic, and there is a lot of research to suggest that we get a lot of ceramide formation, C-E-R-A-M-I-D-E. Ceramides are a species of lipids, and I probably should have done a lipid episode, so I'll just do one at some point, all right? But these ceramides are very important in cells for growth, for proliferation, for apoptosis, for example, right? Very important. Ceramides are very important for apoptotic signaling in cells. So when you have a huge accumulation of ceramides, you can actually cause cell death, right? And you cause also a lot of inflammatory signaling. Free fatty acids themselves, they can stimulate a protein pathway, protein kinase C-theta pathway in the cell. And that activation of that pathway will actually interfere with regular insulin signaling and not allow GLUT4, again, to be brought to the plasma membrane, causing even more glucose toxicity, right? You know, when you have high levels of free fatty acids in the bloodstream, that will also decrease the transcription of GLUT4 genes in the cell, right? So the free fatty acids themselves can worsen the insulin resistance. The free fatty acids can be made into ceramides, which are very toxic in cells and can cause cell death, right? And activation of inflammatory pathways, right? So again, we're so used to only thinking about the glucose aspects that we don't often talk about the fatty acid aspects. And with insulin resistance, you're going to see both, okay? That's the most important thing that I want to emphasize today, because again, over and over, everybody just focuses on, well, then now you have a lot of glucose and the insulin isn't working and the insulin makes you fat, and you know. But if we look at insulin and remember that insulin has been trying to protect you and to keep your body from glucose toxicity and from the release of free fatty acids into the bloodstream, which can be very damaging to organs and cells, then you will appreciate, hopefully, the insulin a lot more. Okay, so I think we can do a quick wrap-up at this point. I started off by talking about the non-glucose disposal aspects of insulin, how that's really important for anabolism, for cell growth, for proliferation, and how you manage cell stress in the body. So it also can increase nitric oxide signaling in the bloodstream to preserve healthy blood vessels and increase blood flow to different parts of the muscle bed, for example, right? Now, when we have high consumption of carbohydrates, we start to stimulate more and more insulin formation and secretion. And over time, if this continues, then we get to a state of hyperinsulinemia, so high levels of insulin. Now, the high blood sugar can be toxic to different cells in the body, but they can also gunk up and mess with the insulin receptor and insulin itself through glycation. And when we do that, we permanently modify the structures of the insulin receptor and the insulin molecule, and this is going to impede proper binding of insulin to the insulin receptor. When that happens, we don't get that signaling cascade that will bring GLUT4 to the plasma membrane to help you bring glucose in to the cell. In addition, we can also upregulate other insulin pathways, primarily the MAPK-ERK pathways, which are prioritizing cell growth and differentiation and proliferation, apoptosis, right, and inflammatory signaling. So we upregulate those aspects of insulin while downregulating the glucose disposal aspects of insulin, right? Now, when the glucose disposal aspects of insulin are not working properly, then what we find is that the insulin is not going to be as efficient in lipogenesis and inhibiting lipolysis, so that we start to see some breakdown of fats into free fatty acids, which are released into the bloodstream. We don't suppress glucagon, we don't suppress gluconeogenesis and the breakdown of glycogen, for example. And so this will keep augmenting the glucose situation, increasing more glucose toxicity in the bloodstream. The free fatty acids themselves can cause more insulin resistance, right, by downregulating GLUT4 action. It can stimulate the protein kinase C theta pathways to upregulate inflammation within the cell and inhibit the signaling of the insulin pathways to help bring glucose into the cell. And these free fatty acids are very toxic. They can form ceramides, a lipid species, which would be involved in cell death and upregulation of inflammation in the body. And it is this imbalanced situation that is called insulin resistance, brings about the metabolic syndrome, and is the initiation of many chronic diseases. So I hope that was clear. I know it was a lot that we discussed today. And if you have questions, again, please, I'd love to see you at my live Q&As. And you can also write comments and send me your questions either via my website or just on the YouTube channel comments, wherever you can put your comments down. All right. I'm sorry, I'm still struggling with recovering from my cold. So I tried not to cough too much, but I apologize if, you know, that kind of burst into your eardrums. I've tried to cough softly. All right, we're done for this episode on insulin resistance. I hope you found it helpful. And again, if you have other topics you'd like me to discuss, let me know. For now, signing out from VLMD Rounds, I am Dr. Vivian Low, and I sing The Body Electric. Thank you. Bye.